happen if your love's still strong. Ooh, baby.
Well, happy Sunday night, and welcome to After Hours with me, with Kogan. I think it's very fitting that tonight, because the weather is so incredibly miserable out there, as winter has finally come back to Chicago, that I think there is nothing better in the world to do on a cold winter night than to curl up with a book. So I have authors on this entire show. So, and all of the books are worth your time and worth your eyes. And the first one, Death of the Angels, The Why of a Tragedy by Alex Burkholder, is a remarkable book about an event that took place 60 years and a few weeks ago. Alec, how are you?
Alex, fine, how are you today?
I'm good. You and I have, you know, come across each other over the years, because you were a journalist of the first rate, even though in the high-priced television field, as we newspaper guys like to put it. But this book, the seed of this book, which is, of course, about the devastating Our Lady of the Angels fire that took place on December 1st, 1958. This is something very, very, very personal to you, is it not?
Very much so, very much so. It really dates back 40 years to when I had started to do a book, and it fell through, and with my years still at WGN and then ABC7, I never really got a chance to do much with it until just a couple of years ago, actually 2017, when I remembered I had all these tapes that were done with three dozen people way back in 1976 and 77.
You know, these were, Alex, and, if I can interrupt you for a second, these were interviews that you did at that time with victims of the fire, with the parents of some of the children who perished in the fire, with some of those mm-hmm. heroic firemen who fought the fire. There were an astonishing 92 people killed in this thing, 101 nuns and students injured. And you did at the time, doing those interviews for you, who was even at the time a young kind of journalism student and working your way up at WGN-TV, those must have been incredibly tough interviews, were they not?
They sure were.
Yeah.
We had one mother who lost her fourth grader in the fire, and her name was Mary Statura, and she lasted a long time. They had moved to Barrington after the fire, her husband and another son, and she passed away just like 2 or 3 years ago in Barrington. But she had quite a terrible time with it, as did most of the parents. Obviously, a lot of the questions were never really answered. Why did it happen? Who's to blame? And finally, I think there is blame to be placed.
Oh, I know. I will get to that as you detail very compellingly near the end. You know, but what happened, and remind people too of this. This fire, I know it. I was in grammar school at the time, not a Catholic school, but a grammar school. This terrified every parent in the entire Chicago area, did it not? The Our Lady of the Angels fire.
Oh yes, yes, they were. And just the way it all worked its way out. Parents didn't know sometimes for days that their child was killed. All they knew was there was a missing child.
Ugh.
And so the pain was tremendous. And you get into that certainly with Steve Lasker, who was a great newspaper photographer, mm-hmm. and then he did television filming, videotaping, and he's still he's out there. He's 88 years old. And he got interviewed 40-some years ago.
Yeah, this is it. Well, you must have been worried though when you initially did these tapes. They were these interviews. They were all done on cassette tapes, which you stored somewhere, I guess, in a box, as you do store cassette tapes. When you went back to the tapes, were you worried about the condition they might be in?
Definitely. I was worried they'd just disintegrate. Because they've been back in the garage, and you got a tremendous heat in summer, and you've got tremendous cold in winter, and these things were sitting on a shelf there, and I was very worried, and so I finally also was difficult to play them back because I couldn't find a player for them anymore.
Sure,
so
sure.
I had to buy one, and. So that went to, I started listening to them, and I cleaned them up. I started listening, and everyone was fine. They all were excellent.
Let me ask you.
I spent possibly hundreds of hours just transcribing them.
When you went back to them, Alex Burkholder, when you went back to them, you did so not just to see if they were, you wanted to, in your fashion, figure out what the hell had happened, why this fire had taken place, and why these many kids had died. Was the mystery solved in the tapes?
Well, it certainly helped, because one of the persons that was interviewed was John Reed, who was an extraordinary man. He was a police officer in Chicago. He left that to become a lawyer, and then he started his own campaign to get honesty from people.
Yeah.
You know, and his company, which still exists to this day, is still checking out people who are being hired to make sure that they're legitimate and they're honest. So he was not the type of man to be fooled by anybody, especially a 10-year-old. Well, actually, he was closer to 12 years old at the time he was
interviewed.
He was interviewed. And the kid confessed to the fire, and he was sent out of state, and he came back. He was released in 1965. He went off to the military, and he wound up in Vietnam, of all places.
Well, and you say that he had a productive life and a family of his own, and you do not, in the book, use his name, but you certainly do use the name of so many others who were involved. Again, the title of the book is Death of the Angels, The Why of the Tragedy by Alex Burkholder, a distinguished, mostly television journalist. We have to take a little break, and after the break we'll be joined by one of the survivors, a man named Richard DeVito, who was an eighth grader at the time, who jumped from room 209 at Our Lady of Angels and lived. And later became a Chicago policeman. He's currently a teacher of criminal justice at Lewis University. And the way you ran into him, Alex, is really a wonder. So please, please stay tuned, everybody. We'll talk some more about this December 1958 tragedy. That song is not played on purpose, but it seems really fitting. It's from a CD called the PB Soul. And rescuing was a huge part of what happened at the Our Lady of Angels fire that took place on December 1st, 1958. One of the young people to escape, and my old friend Alex Burkholder has done a remarkable job of detailing this tragedy in his book, Death of the Angels, and answering the why of the tragedy. One of the people in that school at that time was Richard Rick DeVito. Rick, you're joining us on the phone, aren't you?
I'm here.
It's a remarkable thing that you and Alex, who were in an Army Reserve unit together, started talking about, well, blah, 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 Chicago, and he told you about that he was writing a book, and you accepted his invitation to be interviewed about it. I've got to think, Rick, even though you later became a police officer with the Chicago Police Department and are now teaching criminal justice at Lewis University, that this thing, it must ever be hard to talk about. I cannot imagine something more chilling and haunting, especially at the tender age of eighth grade, for you. Does it haunt you, or have you come to terms with it?
No, it doesn't, actually. I did come to terms with it very quickly after the fire.
Yeah.
It was just something I had to accept. I lost my best friend who lived next door to me, Larry Grasso, and a ton of other friends in the adjacent room, 211. And I did accept it, and I moved on. And quite honestly, I don't dwell on it. Now with the 60-year anniversary, it comes back, of course, but I've been able to handle it.
That's good. That's very, very good for you. When you read, as I'm sure you have, Alex's book, were you ever haunted by, and I'm not saying haunted by, but did you ever feel the need to know, hey, man, how did this happen? Did you feel that need? Did you want answers?
Yeah, I think so. Probably more so now than at the time, quite honestly, because it's strange, but as I've mentioned before in conversations, we weren't really allowed to talk about the fire in school. It was something that was basically off any type of terms that could be discussed. So it made it difficult to even compare notes with the other students.
Wow. Well, that I can kind of understand that. I mean, you know, it's sort of, were there counselors who came in after the fire to talk to you, as they do now, sadly, at every bad event that happens at schools across this country, that you know as well as anybody teaching criminal justice?
Yeah, no, we didn't have any counselors.
No counselors. You just had to come back.
We weren't allowed to discuss it. So
wow.
It was basically like it never happened.
Wow. Alec Burkholder, that must have been one of the difficult things about your initial interviewing, wasn't it? That these young people, especially, and parents, were talking to you about this for the very first time.
Yes. Well, at least they had something like 18 years to get some feeling for the whole thing. But it was it was hard, you know, for some, and since then, some of those people have passed away. The interesting part was there was a second eighth grade room, as Richard talked about, and that was there were the lucky 13. Now, these were 13 students who the pastor, Monsignor Cousin, he went in there about a half hour or so before the fire was actually, occurred. And he asked for volunteers to go next door to the church basement to help work with a Thanksgiving clothing drive.
Wow.
So Bob Raymond, who was the son of the janitor,
mm-hmm.
Jim Raymond, who suffered for decades after that. He was just demoralized totally because some people blamed him for it, that the school was, maybe there was bad cleanup or something. But yet, here you had some 1,600 students. And when you got 1,600 students, it's hard to keep you know, keep everything very sparkling white.
Yeah, of course.
So, he luckily, Bob luckily decided he would go to the church basement. Now, in that classroom, there were like 24 desks. Now, if there had been 13 more students there, the death toll would have gone over 100.
Ugh.
And there was another case, too, where in room 207, that was the nun, she tried to go out the north door, and she couldn't. Obviously, the hallway was just terrible.
Sure.
It was black smoke and heat and flame. And so she couldn't get out the back door of the classroom with her 40-some students because of the she didn't have the key.
Mm.
So fortunately, the janitor, Raymond, Jim Raymond, he was a hero, really. He and a parish priest, they went up there and on the only fire escape in the school, which was on the east side of the building, and they opened that room up, or you would have had another 40-some casualties.
Mm.
So, I mean, it was when you get to it, though, it seems to all boil down to the fact that there were no fire doors on that second floor.
Well, and just the one thing that stunned me, too, was just the one fire escape. You know, I don't like to put words in your mouth, Mr. DeVito, who survived this as an eighth grader, but you have spent your life and career as a Chicago police officer and, in a sense, getting in the business of first responding. You must have thought that the firefighters who did help with that Lady of Angels blaze were heroes, did you not?
Yes, I certainly did. The only, I think, reservations I had were the fact that there were just a dismal response by the fire department at that time because of a lack of communication system and any hard wiring at the school to actually communicate directly to the fire department. It took them quite a bit of time to actually get to the fire.
Were there gentlemen? Well, I'll wait. I mean, I want you both to stay on a little longer. We got to take a commercial break, then get some news, and then I want to explore what kind of not only this young kid who made a confession. Who, as you write in here, Alex, the boy who would ultimately be considered the arsonist was a 10-year-old fifth grader from room 206. We will discuss that and also, for a few minutes, what effect this had. I know it scared every parent in the city of Chicago, but did it have any effect in the overall sort of fire safety for schools? So please, gentlemen, Alex Burkholder and Richard DeVito, please hang on, and you too, listeners, sit tight. Selections from a strange CD that I found, Pottery Barn Soul, Pottery Barn things I used to sell. I have a few more minutes with Alex Burkholder, the author of Death of the Angels, The Why of a Tragedy. It is, of course, about the December 1st, 1958, Our Lady of the Angels fire that killed 92 students. And was haunted.
And three nuns.
And three nuns, and haunted this city forever. We also have on the phone one of the survivors, Richard DeVito, who was an eighth grader who jumped from room 209 and saved himself, later became a Chicago police officer and now teaches criminal justice at Lewis University. Richard, as you know, near the end of the book, Alex Burkholder, in his precise journalistic way, does answer the question, who was responsible for the fire and the fatalities? He says that the arsonist was a 10-year-old fifth grader. Do you trust him on that? Is that your theory? Do you have you? What's your thought about that?
Well, you know, I do support his theory, yeah. Especially after all these years that have passed. A lot of the information we weren't privy to at
sure.
that time, especially with the interrogation by John Reed. It seems more possible than not that the student actually did start the fire because it spread so quickly.
Yeah.
It didn't follow any protocol of most fire scenes.
That, in a way, to me makes it so much sadder that it was not some kind of accidental thing, but was purposely set. And Alex, do you feel that way too?
Well, yes. When you go back to Mrs. Satura, you talk about sadness. This woman had gotten a job at Madigan's, a clothing store on Madison Street, for the first time for the Christmas season.
Mm.
And she heard all these sirens in the neighborhood. And she told us how she started praying. She was a very, very God-strong person. And she started praying for all. She said, somebody out there is having a very bad fire. Well, when she found out about it, her husband called and said, we don't know where we don't know where our son is. She really, she got very shook up, obviously.
Sure.
And she did live to be a ripe old age. But, you don't get over that very easily.
No,
she had many years of suffering, as did a lot of other people.
The amazing thing is both of you gentlemen, Alex Burkholder and Richard DeVito, know this city is a place, more so than most other cities, that is really, fires punctuate our history with sort of frightening frequency. Do you know what I mean? The Great Chicago Fire, the Stockyards Fire, Our Lady of Angels Fire. This is a town that this is a fire town. What, if anything, gentlemen, did you see in the wake of Our Lady of the Angels Fire, that as far as fire codes, was there any sort of ripple effect, any kind of beneficial effect that this had on the way other schools were built, or whether the other schools were protected from fire? What do you think?
Yes, there were, but it's always a case of it takes a disaster to create the changes, and this was a very strong case of that. I mean, as I indicated earlier, there was a fire. There were fire doors on the first floor. Everybody got out on the first floor.
Mm.
There were no fire doors upstairs. Five rooms, actually six. The students were trapped. They had no place to go, and except out the windows. And fortunately for DeVito and the students in 209. They had that canopy over a entrance on a floor below, and they were able to get on that. So that room only suffered two fatalities, whereas other rooms hit 24, 25, and so it was just poor, They had an inspection a couple of months before the fire, and the inspector mentioned the fact that there were no fire doors on the second floor.
Yeah.
And but because of grandfather clauses and,
sure,
old municipal code, he had to mention it. He couldn't demand it.
Wow.
So now Richard J. Daley had only been mayor about a year and a half.
Right.
When that fire happened. And as Bob Weidrich of the Tribune mentioned, he said he had never seen Richard J. Daley cry. He said, but that was the day he saw him cry.
Well, I don't blame him. A lot of us cried, and a lot of us were terrified for forever. I was 7 years old, and And my parents were terrified forever. I cannot thank you enough, Richard DeVito, for joining us. You were a Chicago police officer, a survivor of the fire, and now teach it. I like Louisville University. I've done some speaking there. It's a nice place. You teach criminal justice at Lewis University. Alex Burkhold, you got another book in you, do you? What are you working on?
Maybe.
Okay, good, because you're one of my favorite authors. Alex, it's great
I was very happy to work with the folks at Eckhart's.
Oh, they're great.
Eckhart's Press.
Those guys are great. They did a really nice job of producing your book. It's hard to get a book published these days. Gentlemen, stay warm. Winter is back, but I hope to talk to you again soon.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you both.
Letting us talk about it.
My pleasure. My pleasure, Alex. It's a story that every Chicagoan knows and will know forever. And you've unraveled the mystery. And it makes it even more tragic as far as I'm concerned. So, gentlemen, take care of yourselves and stay warm. That's all I can say.
Thank you.
Okay. Will do.
My pleasure. It really is a fine book, and for those of us of a certain age, I mean, this thing, you know, The Our Lady of Angels Fire is a haunting thing, and Alec is something of a fire buff. He and John Hogan, who used to work in television, co-wrote a couple books talking very much about Chicago. You know, fire strikes the stockyards, it's a history of flame and folly in the jungle, and then Forgotten Fires of Chicago, the Lake Michigan Inferno, and A Century of Flame. Eckhart's Press, which publishes, they'll be doing Ben Anderson's book probably one of these days, and Ernie Skatton's biography, too. Eckhart's Press does all the media-related stuff in this town, and they do a nice, nice job. We'll talk with Barbara Monnier after a short commercial break.
Oh, sookie, sookie now. Hey! Come on, baby. Hey, there, sugar dumplings. Let me tell you something, girl, I've been trying to say now.
Welcome back on this cold, cold Sunday night to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. I have known Barbara Monnier, my next guest, who is on the phone for many, many years now. And it's an amazing thing to know and or to think affectionately of someone. Say, oh, yeah, Barbara Monnier, I remember her. And then read a novel, because I had no idea that Barbara was, and she can detail our misspent relationship and how I could not ever know this. Barbara, how are you?
I'm good, Rick. How are you?
I'm fine. And this Pushing the River, which is your latest novel, is a remarkable book. I devoured this thing. But how is it I didn't know? I met you, I think, when you started working for Remains Theater, yes?
Yes, definitely. And that's been a while. That is what we call back in the day.
Well, tell me, too, what you have in your book, a small portion of which I will read right now. Many years ago, I worked with the Chicago Theater Ensemble. As ensembles are wont to do, we made every effort to cast our play production from within our own pool of 10 or so actors. An enormous pool of talent existed there, but some of the core were definitely not more versatile in their range than others. None was more versatile than Lindsay. She was a chameleon. You tell me later who that's based on and who Lindsay is, and if it is anybody I know. Barbara, take me back. You must have been at the time doing some serious creative writing when I first met you, yeah?
That was the period when I had actually put it on hiatus. I always, from the time I was a child, had thought I wanted to be a writer. I wrote little books literally in crayon on notebook paper and illustrated them with monkeys and giraffes, and studied writing in college as much as one can study writing, and really just assumed that was what I was going to do, and segued into working in the arts very much always in the field of expression.
Sure.
And wanting to work with things that could express the human condition and could help us think about our lives and all of that sort of thing. But when I really was first in Chicago and working in the arts, I put the writing on hold. So when you and I knew each other, I was doing the theater thing and did not get back to the writing until I got into this next part of my life. And now Pushing the River is my third novel.
Wow, that is, congratulations on that. I have ordered the other. I have ordered the previous two because I was so taken with this one. We'll get into this one in some depth. I mean, even the online dating warnings in this thing are pretty compelling, I must tell you. But I don't want to give too much away. Where, Barb Monnier, where are you from? Where did you grow up? Where did you start drawing little animals in crayon?
I grew up essentially in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And through way of a number of locations between then and now, but have now been in Chicago for 38 years.
Wow. Wow.
So, yeah, I think this is officially home.
Where did you, did your parents nurture, was it an artsy household? I always wonder what compels, you know, my household was relatively artsy, so I can understand why I was drawn to newspaper writing, for instance. Was yours?
No, not at all. I was from a family of scientists.
Wow.
And I think probably that's part of what inspired me to write, is I think I felt like such an alien. My father was a physician. My mother, as a woman born in 1920, actually had a PhD in biochemistry.
Wow, that's rare.
And
wow.
Had, so, you know, thought there was nothing more fascinating than dissecting snakes on the kitchen counter. So, no, I was from some different planet, and I think that's why I wrote. I think I was trying to figure out some way to express being so different.
Where did you go to
so
college?
No, it was not nurtured. I think they, I was looked on but, sort of bemusedly. Like,
well,
oh,
but it must have been
interesting.
I mean, anybody, any woman who wound up in a getting a PhD in at the time your mother did is sort of has to be a sort of forthright kind of woman. I mean, they must have been accepting of whatever you wanted to do. When you went to college, did you go to college specifically to study writing, and where did you go?
I did. I went to both University of Michigan and to Yale, which is a whole story for another time.
Sure.
I really did not like Yale for so many, many reasons, but part of which is at the time, their idea of studying writing, if you wanted to be a writer, was to study the old dead white male classics to read.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe at some point that would transform inside of yourself into being a writer, but that wasn't something they believed you actually did as much as you just read.
Was being at the time, Barb, you're not old, but was at the time, was there any sexism involved in any of this too at Yale?
Probably. I was in actually the fifth class of women.
Oh, wow.
That,
wow.
So, yes, I am old. We can say it.
Oh, stop it.
I was in the fifth class, so there was, by the time I entered, still a 2-to-1 ratio.
Whew.
And I think there was still some resentment even. This was not embraced. This was sort of a bit of resentment still that women were on this traditionally male campus.
Yeah, I'll bet. So you get out of Yale, you get out of Michigan, you win some kind of... Tell me about this prize, Barb. I've been looking at your CV, as they say, and you won something called the Avery and Jewel Hopwood Prize. What is that?
That was, you know what, I didn't even know myself at the time. I just found out about this, and I guess it's a fairly well-known literary prize that's sponsored by the University of Michigan, apparently people even sign up for classes there so they can enter this. And it's a cash award. It's nationally judged, and decided to submit what I was working on in a creative writing class and ended up winning the top prize that year. So
that must have been
very exciting.
That also could be very empowering. I mean, it could be so empowering that you say, okay, I'm going to move somewhere, get an attic apartment, and just start writing my head off because I've won this prize. Was it for a short story, or what was it for?
It was actually for something that was intended to be a screenplay.
Wow.
And I was very interested in film and did actually, sort of what you're talking about, move to Hollywood and wanted to try to write for film.
Oh, man, that will kill the writer in you, won't it?
And what can I tell you?
Yeah.
It did.
Yeah.
Nothing like spending a little time in film production thoroughly kill your soul.
You think the people in academia are crazy, idiot, know-nothings. Go to Hollywood and talk to those jokers. So yeah. I don't want to move this along. I want to move this along a little bit. You come to Chicago. You say, I'm not going to write. I'm going to get in the theater. You start working with lovely people like Jennifer Bosnoses, Janice Post, Billy Peterson, Amy Morton, Larry Sloan. And how did you enjoy the theater world? Because that was a pretty creative bunch.
Yes, and that was just a wonderful time to be working with those people and creating with those people. And it was, you know, an ensemble, which is very much sort of like a family and everything good and bad that means.
And its function and its dysfunction. Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. But so much talent and passion and commitment and just striving to put really inventive, good stuff on Chicago theaters.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a real gift.
Had you worked
with that group.
And so during that time, it was not a lengthy time that Remains was a viable entity, but during that time, when did you get back to, I know the Hollywood experience must have soured you on writing a bit. what was it? What was the catalyst for reawakening in you the ability, the astonishing ability that would allow you to create something like Pushing the River?
You know, I think I really got back into my writing seriously after my marriage of more than 20 years ended.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was something about coming back into my own life as an individual, as a single person,
mm-hmm.
that just really brought the writing back to the fore. It was a very important vehicle for me in the process of my sort of getting back on my feet.
You didn't think of it
and
as... It wasn't for you then. It wasn't a sort of therapeutic kind of thing. It was the manifestation of a certain kind of freedom you felt? Or am I making this too romantic?
You know, therapeutic... People have asked me that a lot. Do I find it therapeutic? Do I find it cathartic? And I don't know about you, Rick, but I've actually compared writing frequently to me, it's like one very small step away from torture.
Yeah.
It's really difficult.
Oh, yeah. That's very well put. No, seriously, very well put.
It's difficult because the only reason to do it, the only reason I do it, is because you are just compelled to try and get something right, to try and describe something or tell a story
or make sense of or make
scenario
or
and
of,
you just
don't
have
you also
to get
think
it right.
Barb, it's also to kind of make sense of this crazy place we live.
Yes.
Yeah. This is a joy to talk to you. We're going to continue with Barb Ronier after the news. welcome back. I just grabbed this CD out of a drawer. It's like the Pottery Barn issued CD. I didn't get it myself. I don't think I've ever been in the Pottery Barn. But it issued a CD some time ago, and this one is Pottery Barn Soul, and it's terrific. As is the third narval by my old friend, Barbara Monnier, who is on the phone and who has written a novel titled Pushing the River. It is about memory. It's about the relationship between mothers and daughters. It's a lot about mothers. Barb, can I read just one little part that I just fell in love with?
Please.
My mother thought of herself, it reminds me of my mom. My mother thought of herself as a beautiful woman. I'm not sure how I knew this, but I was certain of it. She went through each day of her life with a confident certainty that her beauty was a given. She never spoke of this and referred to it only once that I can remember. When I was a teenager, maybe 14 or 15, and boys had begun to sniff and circle around our house, my mother said one day, out of the blue, "You definitely have the better body, but I believe that I have the prettier face." Even then, in my dewy youth, I thought, what a weird-ass thing to say. I think that captures... the book is a marvel of good writing, but that captures some of it for me. Barb, do you feel... Does a novelist, never having written one that's published, become more empowered with each novel, or is each one a beast of its own to wrestle with?
Oh, definitely a beast of its own to wrestle with. I'm just at the beginning of the next novel I'm writing, and I was talking to my son and saying that, yeah, I'm in that creative space where half the time you just feel like, oh, I've got this idea, I've got the conception, I know where this is going, these characters are speaking to me, and the other half of the time you just feel like, what am I doing?
Yeah,
I have anything to say or any ability to say it?
Yeah, they're speaking.
The creative tension.
Yeah, they're speaking in a language you don't understand sometimes. I know that feeling. Barb, you have what I think is a very nice website, BarbaraMonnierAuthor.com.
Thank you.
That will tell you about her other books, too. You have a quote from Rita Dragonette, the author of the 14th of September, who was on this show not long ago. Are you two just buddies, or were you part of a writer's group, or are you in a writer's group?
Well, funny enough, we met at a Remains Theater reunion event. We never crossed paths in our respective times there. Me being on the staff, she being a board member, but at different times. So we met at a Remains reunion event.
Oh, how
and
funny.
Went out for coffee because there was an interest, and never realized until a little bit down the road that we were both writers.
Well,
and then have been very good friends and compadres in our writing journeys.
Oh, yeah,
since.
She's a very nice woman, very nice woman. What we should do, though, is have a kind of, maybe next year, a gathering of Christmas books written by former Remains board members and or employees and or actors. So Jen Bosnos could write a book, but I'm not sure Billy has got a book in him. Pushing the River, Barb, I don't want to give too much away. It's... describe it to me. Pretend that I'm an idiot in Hollywood and you're pitching this as a movie.
It's basically the story of a family that goes into crisis around a teen pregnancy. That's the short sort of mini elevator speech.
Right.
Beyond that, it's about a woman who's been living in a house alone and sort of coming to terms with that her children are grown and her marriage is over and sort of reflecting on where her life is. And
yeah.
Within the space of the novel actually takes place, the action of it, within 4 months. And right. over the course of that 4 months, she goes from living alone to first one and then two, and ultimately seven people living in her home.
Including
and the home is actually almost a character in the story. It's very much a presence, the container for all of this combination of craziness and effort.
Yeah, I think it's a remarkable novel. And I can't wait. I ordered your other two, You in the Green Shirt, and a little birdie told me they're on the way to me somehow, however this, you know, Amazon thing works, because I don't even know where a bookstore is anymore. In this new publishing environment, Barbara Monier, as you've gotten into it, you got into this business as the publishing world has been turned upside down. Has that been frustrating for you?
And it's continuing
it's
continually turning upside down. Actually, with my, just to make this very brief, with my, the first novel I finished was You in Your Green Shirt, and I had remarkable luck in landing an agent very quickly, and went through the process lots of writers do of having an agent and having lots of publishers look at it seriously but not take it. And next thing you know, years go by, and that agent retired, and another agent, and the same story. So all of us are faced with, what do we want to do to get our work out there? And do we want to try and go traditional routes? Do we want to go small press? Do we want to self-publish? And the quote, prevailing wisdom changes in a nanosecond.
Yeah, no kidding.
So, yeah, it's very frustrating.
Well, I cannot tell you not only what a pleasure it is to reconnect with you, but what an unbelievable pleasure it is to read you. I can't wait to read the previous two, but I loved Pushing the River. It is... You're just an unbelievably stylish and you pack an emotional punch. Just the little
the
few things I've
that
read
means
are just
a great deal coming from you, Rick Kogan.
Well, stop that. You stop that. Well, keep me posted, Barb. I'd love to sit down and over a drink sometime and figure all this stuff out about publishing. Listen to, if you get a chance, my next guest, Libby Fisher-Hellman, who's been at this game for a long time. She's a very talented writer, like to write thriller mystery stuff. But, man, she's been through, I think she has started self-publishing her last four or five books after, you know, a very conventional career early on. So she may have some insight for those of us befuddled by the publishing biz. But in any case, Barb, I'll be in touch. It's great to reconnect, and you are a great writer, period.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on your show.
My pleasure. Stay warm, hon. Stay warm.
You too. Okay. Bye-bye.
Comes from the a Pottery Barn CD that I picked up at the place in which I live, and that my dear, dear pal Kathy Murray must have bought many years ago. I don't think I've ever been in a Pottery Barn, but I have been a fan of the work of Libby Fisher-Hellman for a very, very long time. Libby, I made the difficult choice to tell you to stay home because it's freezing out. It would be great to see you face to face, but it's always a joy to read you. You know that. Your latest is High Crimes, which features one of my favorite detectives in the world, Georgia Davis. Before we talk specifically about this book, you have had an estimable, couldn't have been easy all the time, and I do want to talk a bit about the changing nature of the publishing business.
Sure.
But you've had an estimable career since moving here 35 years ago. You used to be in the TV business, right?
Right.
What did you do?
I was an associate producer at PBS. Mm-hmm. I was a desk editor at NBC in Washington. I was a talent coordinator for Good Morning America for all of about 6 weeks. I had a lot of jobs in 8 years, and that was one of the reasons why I got out of it eventually.
Why Chicago?
Someone offered me a job at a big PR firm called Burson Marsteller.
Wow.
And I didn't have anything else to do that day, so I said, yeah.
Well, but you obviously, I think it's such a wonderful marriage, if I can use that word, you and this city, because you have plumbed this city in such a literate and exciting kind of way. You found in Chicago a perfect, I think, setting for your work. Did you not?
I did.
Yeah.
And part of it is having come here all those years ago as an outsider and looking at the city and what went on there as an outsider. And I hope to some extent I still have that. I know that Georgia has that.
But oh, no question.
Personality.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah.
When did you first start? Take me back. I know we probably discussed this a million times, but it's been a while. Take me back to when you first began to write crime.
It was here in Chicago. I had never thought of becoming a writer, although I did a lot of writing,
sure,
both in broadcast news,
sure,
and in the public relations business. But it was all nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
Never even thought of writing fiction. The turning point, really, I don't know if I've told you this, was the O.J. Simpson trial.
No, you never did.
You know, I was watching it. I was freelancing. I had left Burson after about 8 years. I needed to stay there to prove to myself that I could hold a job for more than a year and a half. And I was at home with my kids, and I would watch the trial during the day. And I was, first of all, the cast of characters was out of, like,
exactly,
you know, central casting.
Yeah.
You know, the earnest prosecutor, the avuncular F. Lee Bailey, the surfer dude,
mm-hmm,
the football hero. I mean, you couldn't have asked for a better setup. And then there was the big thing was the world of forensics that trial introduced me to. I had no idea that police could analyze blood spatters and find out how the stab wound had occurred. I had no idea that they could take a shoe print of a size, whatever it was,
yeah, right,
Bruno Mali's shoe, and figure out what size it was. I had no idea that, well, we all knew about DNA back then, but there were so many other things that I didn't know about that it was like magic. And I was entranced by it.
Well,
and then, of course, the ending, the denouement, was just, you know,
too much, too much.
Yeah, you know, the acquittal was just amazing.
How did you then, Libby? And you have an extraordinarily good website, Libby, Libby Hellman, Hellmann.com. It is a great website, and one of the reasons is we will get to in a while because of the changing nature of publishing over the last since you watched the OJ trial, let's say. When did you put fingers to computer keyboard or pen to paper after that?
4 months after that. My father died in the interim, and we went to Washington for the funeral,
mm-hmm,
which is where I grew up.
Sure.
And when I got back, I went down into my basement, and 4 months later, I emerged with arguably the worst mystery that has ever been written. It is so bad that I tried to take a look at it, maybe about after I'd published 5 or 6 novels.
Yeah.
I said, well, maybe I can rewrite
there.
It. Maybe,
yeah, maybe there's something there.
I got to page
there.
25. I said, this is so bad. But, of course, at the time, I didn't know what I didn't know.
Sure.
Well, so
did you do it?
I was lucky enough to join a wonderful writers group, stayed in it for actually 20 years.
Wow.
And the fourth book that I wrote was the first book that was published. Ah. It became An Eye for Murder.
Wow. I remember that one. That was a good book.
That was Kelly Foreman.
Well, did you... That's her, Libby's other female detective. You must have been in part, or maybe you didn't even know Sarah Paretsky at the time, or know of Sarah. Did you?
I knew of her, and after I got interested in mysteries, I read a lot of her books.
Sure.
And now we're pretty friendly. And then I followed her. Well, she founded Sisters of Sisters in Crime,
which you later became president.
Right, exactly. So we have connections there, and we also have. I would say that I love it when people say to me, "Oh, you write like Sarah Paretsky," because
that's
biggest compliments you could pay me.
No, I think it's a nice compliment, but I don't think that I've read both of you at length, and I don't think that's true at all. You both have very, very, you have distinctive styles that are your own. I love Sarah too, but
I'm reading her new book right now. Shell Game. I'm going to interview her next month.
Oh, how nice. One of the great things about Chicago that I have ever felt is certainly in the crime, and I use crime as a very big umbrella, is it can be, and you may speak to this too, your own career may speak to this, is it can be a very nurturing environment, can't it?
Well, the people here are
absolutely
wonderful people, very generous with their time and with their knowledge, and particularly here in Chicago, but pretty much all over, everyone is pretty good, pretty friendly, and pretty people that you can trust. And then there's all the people that surround the community, all the experts, all the policemen, all the trial attorneys, all the experts in DNA and now cybersecurity. And they're sort of the outer ring of the community,
sure.
And everyone knows who to call. And if I need an expert in a certain area, you know, I make two phone calls or two emails, and I have it by the end of the day.
That's pretty amazing. What do you think it is? And I know a lot of those guys, too, and they mostly are. They mostly are guys. I don't mean to be sexist here.
No.
But what do you think it is that compels some of those experts in various fields to so eagerly share their expertise?
Because they want you to get it right. When you're writing, and when you're writing about crime, and or you're writing about cybersecurity, or you're writing about a specific location, they want you to get it right, and we want to get it right because we don't want that expert to throw our books against the wall afterwards and say, she doesn't know what she's talking about. I tried to teach her, but she wouldn't listen. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do know what you mean. Yeah. This is, according to your website or some other place I found this, your 15th. Talk to me before we take a break. I'm keeping you on all the way to 11 to talk about this specific book, High Crime. This isn't one of those, hey, tell me what your book's about interviews. It's going to get a little more in-depth here. This the whole... Especially, and we'll get into this later in the show, but the whole nature of publishing where thriller is thriller, crime is crime, suspense is suspense, you have to be kind of pigeonholed. When I consider everything you write under the big umbrella, you and Marcus Sakey and Sarah Paretsky under crime, does that offend you, or how do you feel about that?
Absolutely. I think there needs to be a big umbrella because...
Yeah, good, good.
Yeah, when you pigeonhole authors, it's bad for you because you may not reach out as much and enjoy people that are writing slightly differently than you are.
Right.
And it's bad for us because we don't want to be pigeonholed.
Yeah,
so.
exactly.
Yeah.
There are so many more, and I find this to be true. Over the last 10 years, I would hazard to say that I know more women drawn to the crime genre than I have known men. Am I running in the wrong
direction? Accurate. The problem is that a lot of women write cozies, and that's a very specific niche of the market that is mostly appealing to other women. When you write darker, like I do and like Sarah does, it's a little more challenging because there we are up against the Dennis Lehanes, the Michael Connelly, the, you know, the Marcus Sakeys and Sean Chirkovers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like I feel like I have to earn my spurs.
Gotcha.
You know, I mean, it is male-female thing. How dark can you go and still be appealing to a broad market?
Yeah.
I mean, Gillian Flynn did a wonderful thing. Oh, and she opened up a whole new type of mystery or crime, which is called now domestic noir.
Is it really?
You know, and the unreliable narrator.
I thought it was to have girl in the title of your book. She did do that. And Gillian, too, as you will attest, Libby Fisher-Hellman, is like among the nicest people you'll ever meet.
Yeah, I mean,
it's like crazy. She's
I know. But there's something about before you go to break,
sure.
I do want to say that I think that crime fiction is probably one of the easiest ways to explore social issues and political issues and any kind of international issues, as long as you don't beat your reader over the head with it.
Yeah. Well,
I may have gone a little heavy-handed in high crimes, but there was a reason for it.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, this book was sort of, I have to believe it was kind of inspired by something that happened to you.
Well, we'll get into the backstory of that.
That happened to you on Facebook.
I'd love to tell you and your listeners.
Well, now we're going to get deep into high crimes and the screwed-up world of contemporary publishing. Libby Fisher-Hellman and Rick Kogan will take that on. So please stay tuned, everybody. Libby will be on all the way till 11.
It's your thing. Do what you wanna do. I can't tell you who to sock it to. It's your thing. Do what you wanna do.
Again, gentlemen, from some CD I pulled from the bottom of the drawer. It's the Pottery Barn Soul. Thanks to Ernie Skatten enjoying the New England Patriots victory. Not because he loves the New England Patriots. He's a betting man, and he won a bet. He's the engineer of this show. Ben Anderson is the extremely talented producer of this show. I'm Rick Kogan, and my guest is Libby Hellman, and we're talking about her 15 books, by my count, the latest of which is High Crimes. Libby, you have created two female private eyes, I guess, or investigator.
Right.
Why two? Georgia Davis is the protagonist in High Crimes. Why two? You obviously now are at such a point where they're... Well, you know them both very, very well, and you may say to yourself, "Well, I think Georgia would be better for this story." Or how does that work?
That's not far from where I am. I when I get an idea, I automatically say, "Well, is this going to be a standalone, or is it going to be an Ellie book, or is it going to be a Georgia book?"
Yeah, Ellie Foreman.
And the reason that I have both of them is that, frankly, Ellie is an amateur sleuth,
mm-hmm.
and after four books, it was getting pretty difficult to find a credible reason why a video producer would get into murder investigations.
Right.
I needed somebody whose job it was to do that, and therefore, Georgia had been in a couple of Ellie books and played a fairly prominent role in the third book, and so I decided to suspend her from the police force, where she was an officer, and set up her own shop as a PI.
In one of the books, if we can talk for a second about one that, I mean, I have read, I do believe, all of your books. But one that really,
kind man.
Really, well, one of the standalones, it's not kind at all. I mean, you're a very, very talented writer, and there's, you know, some of these are quite Chicago-centric.
Yes.
Set the Night on Fire was one that I still remember to this day. Talk about that book for a second.
You know, it's almost, the High Crimes and Set the Night on Fire are almost companion.
Yeah, yeah, I felt that, right.
Set the Night on Fire was set both in the present and in the late 60s.
Yep.
In the present, a young girl is being stalked. Someone's trying to kill her. She doesn't know who, and she doesn't know why. And in her increasingly desperate search to figure it out, she finds out that her parents were not the people she thought they were.
Right.
And then we go back to the late 60s, to the eve of the Democratic Convention in 68, and we follow six people who met oh so casually in the park and decided to live together.
Yeah.
In that very, you know, far out. Sure, why not?
Yeah, something I could have done if I had been about 3 years older at the time. Yeah.
Exactly. And during that part, we find out who her parents really were and why the secret had to be kept.
Yeah, it's a remarkable, remarkable
book.
Thank
you. Thank you. It's very funny. I did listen to your previous interview with Barbara.
Oh, yeah.
And you were mentioning Rita Dragonette.
Right.
And I met her last week for the first time at the bookseller.
Come on.
Where she was talking about September 14th. And Susie had a copy of Set the Night on Fire. I said, hey, here you go.
Well, what a wonderfully. See, that's another thing. And one of the reasons I'm glad you stayed, and I'm glad you're here, and I'm sure you're glad why you stayed, is this is a wonderfully, wonderfully small literary world. And you don't, it's not just, you know, a bunch of goofs, men and women, lining up at the bar at O'Rourke's anymore. It's, you know, you'll meet them out and about. To that end.
How did you know I used to hang out at O'Rourke's?
I know everybody used to hang out at O'Rourke's. Are you kidding me? And it was fun to hang out at O'Rourke's. There were a lot of, sadly, I think, Libby, as you well know, there are a lot of books that didn't get written because a lot of people hung out too long, too much at O'Rourke's. But, and that whole, the whole literary bar scene has kind of evaporated. And sometimes you'll see some writers in the Old Town Ale House, but it ain't like the old days. And neither is the publishing business. I mean, I hate to keep beating this to death, but you, I think, are a great, great example of someone who has mastered, maybe not totally, but mastered the increasingly crazy world of publishing.
Thank you. I'm surviving.
Yeah,
I can tell you that.
Which is, to my mind, kind of mastering it. Yeah.
it's a tough world out there, and it gets tougher every day. I just wrote an article on for Crime Reads, which is a online magazine, and I found out a statistic that over 57,000 books are published every day.
Every day?
Every day. Yes. Millions and millions every year. It's unbelievable. I mean, it's unbelievable that anyone can make a living, well, not even make a living, can get a book out there that's going to be read.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, because you and I both, I mean, many of your books went the sort of conventional route, and by conventional, I mean the route that was the way of publishing. You would go get an agent. An agent would determine what might be the best publishing house for this particular book, and then approach an editor there, and a deal, and a deal would be made, and it was, if not...
Predictable.
It was occasionally substantial enough to allow you time to write your next book.
Right.
And you would have an editor and or editors there who would help nurture. Yep. True?
You have it. You have it down. It's very different now. I'm not averse to going back to traditional publishing if the book is a kind of evergreen story.
Right.
That it doesn't, you know, the being sort of a type A, I like to get my books out fairly promptly. And with a traditional publisher, you're going to wait for a year, a year and a half until the book comes out. Small publishers are better, more timely, but the big five are pretty slow. So particularly with High Crimes, I knew I had to self-publish it because I needed it to get out before the end of
of certain term. Yes, yes,
and
yes.
I just made it under the wire.
Yeah. It was inspired. Again, it's a Chicago private eye named George Davis, who is on the trail of someone who, an assassin, I guess, and on the trail of, but also on the assassin of the assassin. A gunman is found in a roof of a hotel very close to Grant Park in Chicago. It involves sort of a search. Facebook becomes something of a villain in, or a, oh, I don't know how to put this. Facebook's not the villain itself, but the villain is hiding somewhere, somehow, in Facebook. How did that come? Well, what's the inspiration for that? Because I think it's so fascinating.
Totally true to life.
Really?
Here, I'll tell you a little of the backstory.
Sure.
After the election, I was shocked, just like the rest of the world.
Sure.
And then I went into a period of rage, although my rage lasted a year.
Wow.
I couldn't write. I couldn't do anything.
Oh,
all I could do was hang out on Twitter and Facebook and read articles and rant. I must have lost tons of friends who hid me on Facebook because I was so vocal. But one of the things I did a couple of days after the election, a new group, a Facebook group was formed, and it was called the Trump-Russia Investigation into the 2016 election. And the woman who started it, her name was Susie Fisher, and it was spelled the same way my name is, with a C. And so at the beginning, we were emailing or messaging, and I was saying, oh, you know, are we relatives or something? She said, no, we're not relatives. My father changed his name. But she shared my rage. And for a good 6 months, we were in touch almost daily about what was going on and what was happening to our country. And meanwhile, the Facebook group exploded. It went up to 42,000 people.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Now, they started to moderate it because there were a lot of trolls coming in and a lot of people who were pretending to be anti-Trump, but they really weren't. And when I finally decided after a year went by that I had been giving him too much of my power, I started to try to think about what I was going to write. And I'm scrolling through the posts on the Facebook group one night, and I say, wow, wait a minute. What if, which of course is the plotter's device that we always use,
what if
a woman started a Facebook group, it mushroomed to 42,000 people, and then she's murdered? Who would have done it and why?
Yeah.
And so the first thing I had to do was get in touch with Susie and say, I have an idea, it's based on the group. Would it be okay
if I killed you in the first chapter?
Borrow it, and and can I talk about the person who created it? Unfortunately, she dies in the first chapter.
What did she say?
She said, fine.
Go.
She said, go for it. Oh. And I actually dedicated the book to her because of she was my inspiration.
That is too priceless.
The group is still going strong. It's lost a few hundred members, but that's okay.
Well, you write in here for Susie Fisher, who for the past 2 years has provided a beacon lighting the way through the dark.
Yes.
This must have been a particularly, I don't know how fast you wrote this, Libby, and I know that you are a professional, but this has a wonderful narrative drive. Was this easy? Was this an easy one to write for you?
You know, it was.
Yeah.
It was easier than some of the others. Once I finally figured out what I was going to write about.
Right.
I wrote half of it in a few months. Then I got stuck, as many writers do halfway through. And I went to help Cat Sit in France, in the south of France.
There's
last
a novel.
July.
Yes, that sounds like a cozy to me, yeah.
No, it was with British author Zoe Sharp, and she was going over there. She said, why don't you come with me? It's an expat British couple who are going away to Italy for a month, and we got ensconced there. There was no TV.
Oh,
there was no
God,
Trump. There were no distractions. I wrote 25,000 words.
Oh.
in 3 weeks and finished the book.
Wow.
Yeah. I have never had an experience like that before in my entire life where it just flowed.
The cat sitter. Libby, we got to take one short little break here and then come back. And I want to close up by asking you specifically about your website and how. I'll just ask the questions. I won't preload. Okay. We'll be back. Here we are with Rick Hogan, back for a few more minutes with Libby Fisher-Hellman. You must go to her website, which is a great website, Libby, L-I-B-B-Y, Hellman.com, to get a look at all of her books. It is a great, great website, which is a necessary element of being a writer these days, without a doubt. Libby, one of the things, even though my knees are weak over your discovery that there are 57,000 books published every day in this country, that will put I can just see some would-be writer out there stopping at his computer going, well, I don't know, I guess that won't work. I can't.
It's very tough. It's very challenging.
Well, your books will ever sell. But what about, how has it hurt you? I remember, years ago, not that many years ago, when newspapers had book review sections, and there were some papers that paid special attention to local authors, even in a place as big as Chicago. Has that lack of attention hurt?
It hasn't helped.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the dearth of bookstores, that hasn't helped either. And the growth of the internet, I mean, everybody is hawking their books, and everybody is doing a podcast, and everybody is doing Facebook ads, and so there's a real glut of everything in terms of social media and books and competition.
Yeah, I find it disturbing in that it's kind of like the Facebook that you discover in your latest novel, High Crimes, where there's just so much noise out there that it's just very, very difficult for people to, how are they supposed to find the good writer? They can't walk in. I guess you could walk into a place like the bookstall or the bookseller and say, hey, I'm looking to find a really cool female detective, and they would be turned on to your work. But it's a tough slog
out
there.
It's not great. It's not a great situation. In some ways, we've created a monster with social media, but we've also, people aren't reading as much every year. The people who read declines. I mean, there's always going to be a core audience of readers, intense readers who read two or three books a week, but. For someone who used to read a dozen books a year, now they're maybe reading five or six because of Netflix, because of YouTube, because of Facebook and Twitter. It's hard.
Yeah, it is hard. But what I noticed from your social online element is it's a very solid, attractive place. And I guess that's...
Well, thank you.
No, I'm not making it up. I mean, it's sort of my...
You never know.
Well,
you never know how much is too much promotion and how much is too little, because you can't measure it, as you well know.
Yeah.
You throw something against the wall and you see what sticks.
Yeah. Do you write every day?
Not anymore. I'm not one of these people that writes three books a year.
Yeah.
Right. Want to have a life?
Well, that would be James Patterson and his band of collaborators.
Yeah, I'm not James Patterson.
Who is?
In fact, I'm going to Vietnam in March, so I'll be gone for 3 weeks. And I've been wanting to go ever since, before I wrote Seven Line on Fire, ever since we lived through the late 60s.
Oh, that, I cannot even imagine. I mean, you must be anticipating that to spark
Yeah, I'm really psyched about it. And of course, I didn't, silly me, we planned the trip for over a year.
Yeah.
And It's only in the last month that I realized I was going to write a book after I got back about the Vietnam War from the perspective of the Vietnamese.
Wow.
There's going to be two sisters. One is going to be pregnant by a U.S. soldier, and the other one is going to be a Viet Cong fighter.
Oof. Ooh.
Yeah, that's going to be fun.
When is it going to be set?
That's a good question. I kind of wanted to set it in 68 because it was such a pivotal year.
Oh, God,
but
no kidding.
I have to get them to the U.S. Most of the refugees didn't come until 75.
Right.
So I'm trying to figure out which era to set it in.
Well, you know what a huge fan I am. I can't wait for that book. I can't wait for every one of your books.
Thank you.
You know, believe me. High Crimes is another great one. Georgia Davis is the...
I do have to say I was very proud of myself. I didn't use his name, the president's name, once in the book.
I noticed, and I think that is an incredible accomplishment, honey. An incredible accomplishment. Libby, stay warm. It's great to talk to you, and it's even better to read you. And enjoy that trip to Vietnam. I'm sure it will be life-altering.
Thank you.
Life-altering.
Thank you, dear. You are a very great interviewer. Love talking to you.
Well, you know, the whole thing is read the book. Read the book, and it becomes a breeze. And read all of your books, and it becomes even easier. Libby, it's always great. Always great to talk to you. Take care, hon.
You too.
Okay. Thanks for listening. Put you all under your covers. If you are like my new engineer, Ernie Skatton, you can go out and spend all of your money that you made today at the unbelievable overtime. He doesn't bet illegally. He only bets with family members. Ben Anderson's a much more sensible guy. Roger Badish, I don't know what he does with his money. Carl Amari is coming up. Thanks a million for listening. Stay warm, folks. Stay warm.